Thank you all for coming this morning. Good morning. My name is Bonnie Glazer. I'm director of the China Power Project here at CSIS. And this is our third annual China Power Conference, a series of debates about Chinese power. As many of you may know, we have a website where we gather together objective data and analysis to look into the economic, military, technological, social aspects of China's rising power relative to other leading countries in the world. I want to say just at the top that I'm your safety officer today, and if there should be any untoward incident, that you will follow my instructions and we will go out the back and down the stairs, but of course we don't expect anything. I want to thank the Carnegie Corporation in New York for its generous support for today's conference and for the entire China Power Project. We're going to begin this morning with a keynote speech by a leading voice on Asia and other critical national security issues in the US Congress. Senator Edward Markey served 37 years in the US House of Representatives before being elected to the US Senate in June of 2013. He now serves as the ranking member on the Subcommittee East Asia, the Pacific, and International Cybersecurity Policy of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Throughout his career, Senator Markey has been a leader on a number of very important national security issues to our country, including nuclear nonproliferation, energy, environmental protection, and telecommunications policy. Along with Senator Gardner, Senator Markey has co-sponsored the Asia Reassurance Act, which is a bipartisan bill that is, I think, likely to be voted into law in the near future. It authorizes approximately $1.5 billion in new funds over the next 5 years for the Departments of Defense, State, and AID to improve the capacity of partner nations and advance American interests in maintaining the rules-based order in the Indo-Pacific region. In addition, Senator Markey is spearheading a series of hearings on China in the Senate, and a third hearing is scheduled for December 4th on China's domestic policy and human rights issues. So it's truly a privilege to have Senator Markey here today to give us his thoughts on China, the opportunities and the challenges that it presents to our country and the world. Please join me in thanking in welcoming Senator Ed Markey.
Thank you, Bonnie, so much. Thank you, Bonnie. Thank you so much for having me here today. Thank you for organizing this wonderful event, which is already an institution after its relatively brief existence, and it's only growing in importance. And it's great to have you do it because you are clearly one of our country's top experts, and I think that leadership is reflected in all of the attention that this incredible forum now attracts. And I applaud your approach to this conference as well, bringing together experts with differing opinions to debate those issues will help inform policymakers and the general public about key components of Chinese and American policies. It's an honor to open today's gathering, especially at a time when China is in the news more than ever, and when both the direction of our bilateral relationship and of the international system are more consequential than ever. For those of you who follow the Asia-Pacific closely, which is everyone in this room, and increasingly those who do not, China has become a significant strategic challenge that demands our attention. The relationship we had originally hoped for with China has not come to be. It is now widely accepted that the responsible stakeholder model in which we increasingly welcomed China into multilateral organizations in the hope that they would help liberalize the country is dead. I supported that approach then, and I still support continued and comprehensive engagement between our countries, but as a large and growing power, China absolutely should have a seat at the table. After all, neither containment nor exclusion are reasonable policies. But it is clear that our hopes about the direction of China's government and its policies have not come to fruition. And I have deep concerns about the trajectory of some of the Chinese Communist Party's policies and activities. It is therefore incumbent upon us to both speak out about these policies and to help devise and advocate for concrete solutions. So my goal is not to bash China. Instead, it is to have a discussion and a debate. How can and should we respond to the Chinese government policies in the economic, military, and diplomatic realms that may not always align with the interests and values of the United States? First, economically, I and others have concerns about China's use of economic coercive tools against U.S. allies, partners, and companies. China asserts that these activities help protect it as a nation still developing. But to me, and to others as well, these activities have put Asia on edge, threatened the livelihoods of American workers, and expropriated American innovation and ingenuity. Taken together, these actions are eroding the principles of the international rules-based system. The Chinese Communist Party is directing targeted economic pressure against smaller countries to achieve specific diplomatic goals, often doing so through informal or indirect measures that make it easier to deny discriminatory or coercive intent. For example, in response to an alliance effort to help defend South Korea from North Korean ballistic missiles, the Chinese government directed an economic pressure campaign targeting the South Korean government and people. This months-long, high-profile campaign by China against South Korea caused South Korea more than $15 billion for cooperating with the West in trying to isolate the North Korean nuclear program. So dollar figures like that tend to change minds and ring alarm bells. That's what China's intent was. And this is not an isolated incident. We have seen similar measures against other U.S. allies like Japan and the Philippines. And furthermore, the Chinese government has used economic incentives and pressure to persuade countries to isolate Taiwan diplomatically. And since 2016, six countries have severed diplomatic relationships with Taipei in favor of ties with Beijing instead. American companies feel government pressure to refer to Taiwan as a part of China on their websites, lest they lose access to one of the world's largest markets. And they fear for their intellectual property rights. In one example, American Semiconductor, an energy technology company that produces chips for wind turbines from my home state of Massachusetts, partnered with a Chinese government that owns a Chinese company, which then stole the intellectual property of American Superconductor and used it against them competitively. These practices cannot continue if we are ever to have an equitable, mutually respectful relationship with China. At the same time, China is also creating economic structures that exclude the United States, including the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, and the Belt and Road Initiative. In many cases, these initiatives lack the commitment to anti-corruption, environmental safeguards, good governance that we have come to expect. China's foreign assistance policies, which include low-interest infrastructure loans, have enticed a number of developing countries to forego World Bank and International Monetary Fund programs. Unfortunately, this has left a number of them susceptible to above-average debt and subject to undue pressure from Beijing, which is their intent. Under the Belt and Road Initiative, which aims to position China as the, quote, uncontested leading power in Asia, Beijing may further coerce its neighbors through loans they can't repay. In one highly publicized example, Sri Lanka's government struggled to make payments on the debt it had taken on as part of a deal with China. After months of negotiations, the government handed over a huge port and 15,000 acres of land around it to a Chinese company partially owned by the Chinese government for 99 years. Transferring this land gives China control of territory near India and a strategically important commercial and military waterway. And this is just one example of what appears to be a growing trend around the world. And I fear that if we will only see more of this activity in the future, it is going to repeat itself over and over again. Because China is also using economic and trade policy to affect U.S. engagement with North Korea. Sanctions enforcement is easing, allowing banned goods and resources into North Korea, undermining U.S. leverage to negotiate an end to the country's nuclear weapons and ballistic missile programs. China instead could play a more helpful role by ensuring that the United Nations Security Council resolutions are thoroughly enforced, thereby supporting the direct engagement and diplomacy we need to help create the lasting peace which we seek. But it's not just economic issues that are of concern. There are worries that come with China's continued military rise. According to the most recent Defense Department report on Chinese military and security developments, quote, in support of the goal to establish a powerful and prosperous China, the China dream includes a commitment to developing military power commensurate with that of a great power. And as a result, the People's Liberation Army is, quote, undergoing the most comprehensive restructure in its history. As part of these efforts, China is building a blue water navy. It is streamlining and modernizing its ground forces. It is updating its nuclear arsenal and developing hypersonic weapons. And it has built military bases on artificial lands in contravention of international law in the South China Sea. And I want to applaud, by the way, the groundbreaking work CSIS has done on China's activities in the South China Sea. The Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative has shed much needed light on the construction of the military bases that now dot the seascape. So we thank you for that historic work. But these PLA developments taken together are significant, and they raise legitimate questions about China's intent. Finally, we are witnessing troubling developments in the areas of fundamental freedoms and human rights. This pertains to China's policies both at home and abroad. Domestically, the Chinese Communist Party crackdown on dissent is deeply troubling. We see this in China's tightening restrictions on demonstrations and activism on its university campuses. We see this in the Chinese government policy of banning American citizens from leaving China. And we see this in the ever more sophisticated online censorship that companies, including Google, who are working with Chinese authorities to restrict the flow of information inside of China. And the Chinese Communist Party's policies towards ethnic minorities have been particularly troubling. We are all aware of the government's efforts to politically and culturally repress the rights of Tibetans. The government has also restricted access by diplomats, journalists, and international observers to the region, which limits the world's ability to know what is happening. And more recently, these practices of political and cultural repression are being repeated in the Xinjiang province, where the Chinese authorities have placed up to 1 million Muslim Uyghurs in so-called re-education camps, and reportedly have used torture to force members of the community to renounce their faith. The same senior officials leading this effort was also the leading official in Tibet, showing the government's interest in practicing similar approaches. Troubling, Chinese government policy is reaching beyond its borders as well, helping to prop up authoritarian governments and undercutting global efforts to promote democratic norms. For example, China is working through the United Nations Security Council to protect the government in Burma from international condemnation for its brutal assault on the Rohingya. It is weakening international efforts to pressure the Hun Sen regime in Cambodia by offering financial loans. It is giving lucrative lines of credit to Venezuela as the world tries to isolate President Maduro. And it is noticeably silent on President Duterte's drug war in the Philippines. But what is even more troubling is that countries and companies, fearful of losing out on Chinese largesse, are biting their tongues when it comes to fundamental freedoms and human rights. At a recent UN Human Rights Council review, numerous countries congratulated the Chinese government's efforts to support human rights despite ample, incontrovertible evidence to the contrary. In short, the size of China's economy and the CCP's willingness to use it as a coercive tool is clearing a pathway for policies and activities that are out of step with international norms. Which brings me to the more important part of this, what we need to do going forward. Because we, in many ways, have been too reactive. Militarily, we were focused for the past 17 years on fighting wars in the greater Middle East. And now, we are catching up to the realities of the new geopolitical landscape. All the while, China increased its influence throughout Asia and beyond, as our attention was directed elsewhere, away from larger, more consequential challenges to the international order and the American way of life. Economically, we have spent the past decade trying to recover from the financial crisis. And in areas where we could expand U.S. influence and growth throughout Asia, we missed opportunities to establish deeper and more substantial trade and economic ties. The first step is to turn around some current policies. While we need to be tougher on Chinese trade practices, President Trump's approach to tariffs on Chinese goods has been misguided and counterproductive. Initially, I might be in agreement with the president, but instead of working with our longtime allies in Europe and Asia on trade, the administration has taken aim at them in a number of cases. Rather, we must make sure that the administration does not strike a deal with China that helps tactically roll back the tariff dispute President Trump created, but fails to address the key strategic structural issues. We must account for state-backed theft of intellectual property, as in the Massachusetts company American Superconductor's case. We must demand an even playing field for U.S. companies in China, because China must be an equally responsible international actor if it is to receive the equal benefits of globalization and international partnership. And we must reaffirm our commitment to international norms, standards, and values that have underpinned global stability since World War II. Our leadership in the Bretton Woods institutions has been essential to promoting economic development and stability in the post-war landscape, during and after the Cold War, and through ethnic and sectarian conflicts, civil wars, and transnational threats. And it will be essential in the era of renewed great power competition. So we must maintain U.S. leadership in institutions like the World Bank and the IMF. Unfortunately, this administration has expressed a deep suspicion towards multilateral institutions that is raising doubts about our continued leadership. And this makes it harder to ensure China plays by the rules that have long brought prosperity and equality far and wide. President Trump proposed 20% cuts to our commitment to multilateral development banks in 2017 and 2018. And almost as damaging was President Trump's adherence to the false choice of nationalism over globalism. We can and we must promote American interests and values while maintaining a leadership role in the world. Such language undoubtedly weakens our position in these institutions and among international partners and encourages others to provide alternatives. But we also need to empower the new International Development Finance Corporation, or IDFC, created by the BUILD Act, which recently became law. In fact, CSIS experts call the legislation, quote, the most important piece of U.S. soft power legislation in more than a decade. And I was proud to help strengthen the language in the bill on environmental standards. But the $60 billion program pales in comparison to the $1 trillion in infrastructure investments promised by China around the world. So we must ask ourselves, even when countries do fully recognize the risks of risky infrastructure development loans, if there is no viable alternative, then what choice to local, regional, and national politicians do they have? They turn to where the money is. And that, unfortunately, is the pattern that we're seeing happen over and over again in country after country. Diplomatically, we must double down on Asia. We must fully fund the State Department and fill senior positions that remain vacant. We must cultivate a new generation of Asia watchers and China hands. And we should expand cultural and educational exchanges and promote more Chinese language studies. Because U.S.-China relations are too important. Asia writ large is too important. And rhetoric alone will not solve our issues with China nor assert America's role in the world's most important region. And above all, we must make clear that our issue is not with the Chinese people or the country as a whole. For we must not fall into the trap of becoming anti-China. Rather, we must focus on specific Chinese government policies that do not accord with U.S. interests and values and those of the majority of the world. And it is up to us to do something about it. As we speak, Senator Cory Gardner and I, the chairman and the ranking Democrat on the East Asia Subcommittee, are trying to push the Asia Reassurance Initiative Act, or AREA, across the finish line. We hope it will pass out of the Senate shortly and be on the way to the House. This wide-ranging bill is intended to demonstrate that there is bipartisan support in both the executive and legislative branches for strong and proactive American policies throughout Asia. It would authorize $1.5 billion each year for the next 5 years for the State Department, USAID, and the Defense Department to advance U.S. foreign policy interests in the region. It reaffirms our security alliances with Japan, South Korea, Thailand, the Philippines, and Australia, and advocates for increasing our security partnerships in Southeast Asia. It would encourage the President to produce a robust and comprehensive trade capacity building and facilitation strategy, including to level the playing field for American companies competing in the region. It would require the President to report to Congress about U.S. government efforts to combat intellectual property violations and commercial cyber-enabled theft in the Indo-Pacific. It would support civil society and institutions that promote democracy and good governance. It would urge the President to impose targeted financial penalties and visa ban sanctions on any individual or entity that violates human rights or religious freedoms or engages in censorship activities. And it would urge the President to suspend U.S. economic assistance to any country that has engaged in serious violations of human rights or religious freedoms. But beyond these measures, I urge us all to look at the China challenge through a different lens, U.S. domestic policy. After all, the more we improve upon the already great attributes of this country, the better we will be positioned to face challenges around the world. We need to ensure that our universities are the best, with the most open academic environments that hone critical thinking skills and prepare students for success. We must continue to be the kind of country that draws people seeking a better life. America must continue to lead on advanced technologies, from robotics to artificial intelligence to 5G networks. China is sprinting ahead. We don't have a plan. We don't have to be afraid of China. But if we don't have a plan, they will win. And we cannot afford to lose the 5G race. It is going to turn the whole world and all of the technologies into it, into a digital world. Every device. China is ahead of us. We don't have a plan that anyone in this room could articulate with regard to our plan in 5G. We couldn't even talk about the names of the companies in the United States who are the leaders in 5G. There is no plan. Nothing. China is sprinting ahead. The United States needs to be the global leader in renewable energy, including solar, and staying competitive by keeping pace with renewable installation as well as investment. When the President imposes a 30% tariff on importation of Chinese solar panels, that just leads to a reduction in solar installation in the United States because it could become so much more expensive, and then we lose our credibility in saying that we are, in fact, leading in solar. And then, in turn, the Chinese look at us and say, you cannot preach temperance from a bar stool. You can't not tell us to reduce our emissions while you yourself are walking away from the Paris Agreement, walking away from investment in renewables, walking away from the law which increased the fuel economy standards on your vehicles. You can't preach to us, the Chinese, and tell us to do things that you're not doing. That's not leadership. That's being the international laggard on these issues. It took a lot of work to reach the point where we had an international agreement. The only reason the Chinese came to the table is they were being pressured by the United States government. And now, as soon as Trump takes over, we walk away. The President says he's going to undermine investments in all of these technologies. Well, don't think the Chinese aren't going to start to just build more coal-burning plants. Yeah, they'll do solar. They'll do electric vehicles, but they'll do far more coal than they would have ever gotten away with if the United States was being the leader. So we have to have our own values. We have to have our own goals, which we are using. Because in area after area, we're not on the playing field. This administration just walks away. What's their 5G plan? Love to hear it. What's their climate plan? Love to hear it. The dangers are clear. The challenge is there. But where
not on the playing field. So for me, we just can't lose our moral compass as a country. Countless people around the world depend on us to defend the downtrodden. We simply can't let them down. China's influence around the globe is an important and growing issue. And I, for one, have been tracking closely as the ranking member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee all of these issues. And it's not going to go away anytime soon. It's clear that we are in a strategic competition with China and will continue to be so for the foreseeable future. But that is not the only way we should be viewing our relationship with China. For our own benefit and that of countless others around the world, we should be focused on the continuation of the rules-based order and upholding the values, norms, and standards we have promoted for decades. Sometimes that will mean working with China, and other times it won't. But when it doesn't, we must be willing to meet the challenge with innovation, send a firm commitment to American values in each and every instance. So I thank each and every one of you for all of your interest in these issues. I thank you, Bonnie, for inviting me to speak with you today. And if you would like, I'm in a position here to, before the session opens, to take a few questions, if anyone has any.
Thank you so much, Senator. Thank you for your comprehensive analysis, your concrete policy recommendations, and of course, your lifelong service to our country. So we do have just a couple of minutes, so I'd appreciate if you wait for the microphone to come to you and identify yourself and make a very brief, concise question. All right, we'll start here in the front with Professor Wu Xinbo. There's the microphone.
Wu Xinbo from China, Fudan University in Shanghai. Good morning, Senator. You just mentioned that China tried to use regional economic institutions to exclude the United States from this region, and you refer to AIIB, Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank. Actually, my memory is that China tried its best to invite the U.S. to join AIIB, but declined by the Obama administration. So if that is the case, would you recommend to the Trump administration or the future U.S. administration that U.S. should join this important regional financial institution? Thank you.
I had a little difficulty hearing that question.
Sure. Professor Wu was asking about the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank and whether the United States should now join it.
Well, from my perspective, I think that that's a clear plan on China's part to isolate us. And so we have to have our own plan. We need our own plan. That's what our bill, ARIA, is all about today. We hope it passes the Senate in the next 2 days, then it will go over to the House. Our goal is to begin to create institutions that can draw these companies towards the rules-based system that we have, rather than entering into a system that is going to be more dependent upon Chinese-based rules, which clearly will not reflect the values of our country. Yes.
Okay. Up front here, the woman sitting at the front table. Where's the microphone? Okay, it's coming behind you.
Thank you. Siyang, reporter from Voice America. Senator, you mentioned striking a deal with China. So President Trump and President Xi Jinping is going to meet by the end of this week. So do you think they're going to strike a deal? If so, what kind of deal you would like to see? Thank you.
Well, I'm very skeptical that they are going to strike a deal. But if they do strike a deal, what my greatest fear will be is that they'll leave a whole series of very important questions unresolved. And at the top of that list will be intellectual property protections, which have gone unaddressed for a generation, and human rights and other issues that will still be shunted to the side. So while I'm doubtful that they'll reach a comprehensive tariff resolution. Even if they do, there are still too many other issues that deal with, and we come back to American Superconductor, you know, and their intellectual property that still will not be dealt with, and it must be dealt with. We have to get to the core of that issue.
We're going to take one last question. Okay, Scott Kennedy here in front.
Thank you, Senator. I wanted to follow up on a couple of the other questions. You mentioned the challenges with AIB, but President Obama negotiated with other countries in the region the Trans-Pacific Partnership. President Trump, when he came into office, withdrew from TPP. The other 11 countries have gone ahead without the United States. I recognize that many had issues with the TPP as it was originally drafted. What kind of changes do you think would need to be made to TPP in order for you to recommend that the United States try and rejoin and create a rules-based order that was consistent with our interests?
Okay, and that's a very good question. And that's an area where I agree with Donald Trump. Donald Trump's concerns were that there were not enough protections for American workers, there weren't enough protections for the environment, and that they had to be strengthened. I'm not so sure he really cared that much about the environment, but at least the workers he mentioned in speech after speech in Ohio and Pennsylvania and Michigan, you know, to build in real protections to make sure it's not a one-way street. So if the president goes back to renegotiate, you know, a bill, a treaty, then it, and he's successful in including stronger protections, then that's something that I think people would be interested in, because it's clear that we can't isolate ourselves, but we can't also just become Uncle Sucker in too many of these deals, where it just winds up with our jobs heading one way and then products coming back our way made by Chinese workers. Anyway, thank you all so much for your attention today. Thank you for your interest in this issue. It's at the top of the list of our diplomatic, military, economic, and moral challenges for the 21st century. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you.